NHL, the Blackhawks host the Philadelphia Flyers. Now the WGTD Wednesday forecast from the National Weather Service, cloudy and cool, 80% chance of afternoon rain, a high of 46 with winds up to 20 miles per hour this afternoon. Right now, wind from the south at 7, it's overcast and 37 degrees. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg, next.
Support for The Morning Show comes from Jack and Drea, a Kenosha tradition since 1911. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe, Jack and Drea, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. Support for The Morning Show also comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information is available at carthage.edu/grad. And we welcome you to the Wednesday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. That is the sound of the heavy metal band Lamb of God, one of the most highly regarded such groups in the world, nominated for Grammy Awards several times over. I recently had the great privilege of speaking with the lead vocalist for Lamb of God, D. Randall Bly, who has written an extraordinary memoir called Dark Days. In this book, D. Randall Bly talks about his place in the world of professional music. He likens himself to be a budget rock star. He talks at great length about his longtime battle with alcoholism. But chiefly, the book Dark Days is about an ordeal which D. Randall Bly experienced when he was arrested in Prague shortly after his band landed there to play a concert. They had played their first concert in Prague 2 years prior to that. And at that concert, a young man from the stage, as often happens at heavy metal concerts, stormed the stage trying to join with the musicians. It was just too small a stage for that to happen. And this young man was essentially expelled from the stage more and more forcefully as he kept climbing back, not getting the idea that he wasn't welcome up there, and it was an unsafe situation. Finally, he was expelled from the stage so forcefully that he struck his head and suffered injuries which led to his death shortly thereafter. Czech authorities believed that D. Randall Bly was responsible for that injury, which is why when the band next landed in Prague, he was taken into custody at the airport and ultimately charged with what amounts to manslaughter. And thus began a really frightening ordeal in which D. Randall Bly was taken and incarcerated in what was widely regarded as the worst prison in the Czech Republic, imprisoned in a place where he did not speak the language and did not understand the rules or just what was or was not permitted under Czech law. And with his own American embassy in Prague largely ineffectual in helping him, it was a very, very frightening situation indeed. D. Randall Blye writes about it with very, very vivid potency in this book. Again, the memoir is called Dark Days. It is published by Da Capo Press. We began our conversation on yesterday's morning show. We finish it out today. You tell us a lot of interesting details, and of course, we don't begin to have enough time to talk about all of them, but I really appreciated the time you took to explain what it's actually like when one has mug shots taken.
Right.
You know, you're quite right that most of us, it's just what we might see on the evening news or Entertainment Tonight, some kind of grim-looking portrait of someone. But mug shots, particularly apparently in a place like the Czech Republic, really end up being an ordeal unto themselves. Tell our listeners about it.
Sure. I take it you've never been arrested before, more than likely. It's something that most people, thankfully, will never have to go through. I forget that at times. I'm a little bit outside the norm in that respect. But generally, when you get a mugshot, it's not the classic that you see in the movie, someone up against a wall with a height chart beside them and a picture taken. If you have any scars, birthmarks, any identifying marks, they photograph you, and they stripped me down to my boxers and just sat there. And I have tattoos, and they started taking shots of all my tattoos and critiquing them to the point where I was like, okay, this is getting kind of ridiculous. You guys are just checking out my tattoos now. You're not taking my pictures. So I started to drop my shorts. And they were like, whoa, 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 whoa. They hurried up and finished taking the photos. You have to get fingerprinted, and that takes a while. The Czechs fingerprinted my entire palm. And they take photos of you from all different angles. So it's a lengthy process. It's not like they just prop you up against a wall and say smile and the flashbulb goes off and there's your mugshot. They're looking for all sorts of any sort of identifying marks on your body, not just your face, any sort of scars, tattoos, any sort of unusual markings. So it takes more than just a snapshot's time.
You are ultimately taken to what someone described as the worst prison in all of the Czech Republic, a prison which had been built back in 1885, known as Penrats. And it sounds, from all that you tell us, like an incredibly grim place, even as far as prisons go. At one point, you liken it to a medieval dungeon. Describe what this place was like, and in particular, your cell, which you were held for some weeks. What were you given? What did it feel like? What did it look like?
Well, Pankratz was 123 years old when I was arrested. It was built during the time of the Austro-Hungarian Empire when they were in control of the Czech Republic. And it has not much has changed there since then. It's on the outside, they've painted it. When I saw it on the outside, I thought, oh, this might not be that bad. Then once you go past the prison walls and go in there, it's dark. It's extremely dirty. Very, very filthy. So parts of it, I didn't get to walk around much in the prison because that's not what prison is like. It's not like you can just say, oh, I'm going to go over to the West Wing today. you're kind of carried where you're going to go. But I did take several journeys through the prison during my incarceration to see a lawyer or go see a doctor. And I saw parts of the prison that looked abandoned. It looked like urban blight almost, like bad parts of downtown Detroit almost, abandoned. There's broken windows, just rusty bars, all that stuff. My cell, there was the first I was kept in three different cells. And the first cell I was kept in, which is where all prisoners go at Pancratz when they're arrested, was in the basement. And the reason why everybody goes to this basement to be processed for a period of 1 week to a month, there's no direct sunlight. The only ventilation you have is this small window set up high. My floor of the cell was loose, torn linoleum. The paint was peeling. The toilet was barely bolted to the floor. A lot of things had kind of been jury-rigged by previous prisoners. There was a curtain by the toilet made out of an old shower curtain that was tied up with cordage that someone had made out of a ripped pillowcase. It was a pretty grim place, a lot of mildew, a lot of bugs. And the reason why they put you in the basement there first, everyone goes to there for a while, is to monitor you for depression. So I guess what better way to figure out if a prisoner is prone to depression or perhaps suicidal thought than to stick them in the most depressing part of the prison with no... Of course. If you weren't depressed before, then you will be after you go there. Mm. In fact, I got lucky. I had a fellow prisoner tell me, he said, the one of the few that spoke English, he said, look, you're going to be taken to a psychiatrist for evaluation. When she asks you what you think of the prison, do not tell her the truth. Tell her you are happy. Tell her you are fine. Otherwise, you will be stuck down here longer, because he unfortunately told the psychiatrist the truth, and they stuck him in the basement longer. So it's a really grim place.
You describe at one point the few meager belongings which you still had and what were sort of in this grim little prison cell. One of the things that was there was a razor. And you say its presence in our cell was powerfully symbolic to me. Why was that small little razor powerfully symbolic?
Well, it was a piece of a safety razor, and it was illegal to have it in there. It was in there when I got there. My cellmate showed it to me. And, of course, the authorities would be worried about you using it as a weapon, and you can make a homemade slashing tool with a bit of a safety razor and a toothbrush. You could affix it to the handle. But that's not really why it was in the cell, why we kept it around. We kept it as a cutting instrument to, cut things. Like, we made a homemade chessboard, and we made the pieces out of a piece of a toothpaste carton, and we needed something to cut the pieces out with. We drew the pawns and the queens and all that stuff on it. We needed something to cut it with. So it was this little piece of safety razor that my cellmate had hidden. The reason why it was so symbolic to me was it was really a physical embodiment of the refusal to accept my situation fully, to not be fully resigned to the fact that I'm in this place and that I still have a little bit of individual identity, because prison is very dehumanizing. You're just a number, and there's very stringent rules. And having this little tiny piece of a razor, which we use as a tool, is quite valuable, was a sort of the physical embodiment of defiance, I think, over my situation. And my cellmate, he wasn't a murderer. He was another alcoholic. I gathered that pretty quickly, who was there in the Czech Republic from Mongolia due to a lack of a visa violation. So he wasn't some sort of bad guy, some sort of tough guy. So I wasn't particularly worried when he showed me this razor, but it was just nice to have something small that said, hey, I'm not just a number, and I'm not going to let myself enter that mental state, as it were. I'm not going to be controlled by my circumstances completely.
Hmm. Among the many interesting observations you make about what it was like to be incarcerated in a place like this was the utter sense of timelessness which you so often felt. I mean, there were long, long stretches of time where you had hardly the slightest notion of what kind of time had elapsed. Tell us more about what you, in a sense, ultimately learned about time, what time means, and what it felt like to live in such a strange, new sort of circumstance.
Right. Well, I've thought a lot about time, and the concept of time is a man-made construct. It's a way, it's our way of measuring our passage through life. And of course, I mean, this goes, you can get really deep and philosophical when you start thinking about time. but for me, time passing in prison, it seemed to pass at such a different rate, not just because you're locked up. If you do 8 hours in the county jail, which I hope you never do, it will be the longest 8 hours of your life. Time seems to pass at a different rate within there. But for a lot of the beginning of my incarceration, I had no way of telling time. And as I said earlier, I was in the basement, so I couldn't even look at the position of the sun in the sky to see what time of the day it was. With no watch, no way to see where the sun was in the sky, I had no idea of what time it was, how much time had elapsed, and I had no way to, I guess, measure my movement through existence, really. And it made me really realize how much we use time to almost validate our existence. And when that sense of your place within the time, the stream of time is removed, it can almost make you feel as if your very existence has been invalidated. So it's a very odd feeling to have no concept of time and to be stuck in a small room for 23 hours a day. We were allowed out for 1 hour each day. And during that time, I would walk out to this small enclosed area with the rest of the prisoners on my cell block, and there was an old clock tower that looked over this sort of cage they kept us in. And I noticed everyone every day would frantically look up and check it. And it's not as if knowing what time it was going to change our circumstance at all. We were still in prison. Just because I know it was 3 o'clock at that particular moment does not mean that I'm not in prison, that anything has changed. But knowing, even just for a moment, I noticed people would check the clock periodically when we were outside. It let us know that we were still moving through the time-space continuum, that time was still moving, and that I was still a part of life itself, I think. It's kind of a hard thing to understand until your sense of the ability to measure time is removed. It's kind of hard to understand. So seeing this clock, this dilapidated old clock tower, was almost a validation of my existence itself. And I so looked forward to it every day when I saw it.
One of the things you did in that in prison was keep a journal. Beyond the obvious, what function did it serve for you to keep a journal? Some of the pages of which, by the way, we get to see in this book. What did that journal mean to you?
Right. Well, when I started the journal, I didn't get the journal. I'd had it. I always have a pocket notebook with me at all times because I never know when I might need to write something down, you know, a lyric idea or just an idea for anything. I come up with creative concepts. I never know when they're going to strike me. And if I don't have it, something to write it down with, then they often disappear. So I've always had a notebook on me. And when I was first arrested, they took everything away from me. And when I went to prison, after a few days, they gave me my notebook back. So I immediately wrote down everything I remembered from the second of my arrest up until that second. And that was a very pragmatic thing for me to do, simply as far as my legal ordeal, because I knew I was eventually going to have to go to court, and I wanted to get all the details I could down as soon as I remembered them. So then, as a person who, you know, I'm professionally, I'm a creative person. It's what I do in different ways, you know. And so in prison, there's not a lot of creative outlets. Writing was one creative outlet I had to keep the old creative muscles churning up in my head. I didn't really have anyone to talk to either. My cellmate, by the end, I'd taught him some rudimentary English. He was Mongolian, and I'd learned a tiny bit of Czech, but certainly not enough to have any sort of conversation of any sort of weight or depth. So writing down my thoughts was almost a form of conversation. And to be perfectly honest, on a grimmer note, people die in prison from various means. You know, they might get killed. There might be a riot. You may become ill. There's people who get ill in prison, and the health care isn't the best. For me, keeping that journal, I wanted my family, in case I didn't make it out of prison, for them to be able to, you know my situation rather than be some sort of mystery. So that's kind of a grim note, but I thought about that as well.
Right.
What helped me process to write, you know.
One of the things that made a gigantic difference for you was when you seized upon a word that isn't necessarily one of those touchy-feely, feel-good words, not like hope or peace or love. The word that in some respects was the most important lifeline for you was discipline. And you constructed a very impressive framework of discipline early on in your incarceration, and we can tell from the way you write about it that this made a gigantic difference in your own well-being, even in the midst of something so awful. Explain what a difference discipline made in this experience for you.
Well, for me, when you're arrested and sent to prison in any country, not just a foreign country, I think it would become very easy to become complacent and sort of apathetic as to your situation, and that would lead to despair in my case. My cellmate really did nothing with his time except for lay there and stare at the walls for the entire time he was awake, and that would have driven me completely nuts. I couldn't understand that. For me, I realized right away that if I was going to maintain a positive mental attitude, I was going to have to do something other than just sit there and tell myself, okay, everything's going to work out, you know. I would have to do some things. And for me, it was mental, physical, spiritual discipline. I made myself exercise quite a bit. You see that. Anyone who watches a prison show, they see the guys in the yard lifting these heavy weights. There was none of that in this prison I was in. So physically, I made myself. I did a lot of push-ups, a lot of squats. I used what little furniture we had to do as weights, as makeshift weights. And I did that in order to keep my body in the best shape that it could, because the mind and body are intertwined, healthy body, healthy mind, and vice versa. And mentally, I made myself write. I made myself read as much as possible. Once I was able to get some books, that was a huge, huge problem at first, was no English books. It was really, they might as well have just taken away my my air, my food. I am a book person.
At what point you said you were so sick of rereading and rereading and rereading the insurance card in your wallet?
Right. I had gotten my insurance card. I knew the numbers. I knew where it was issued, what date it was issued. I was just rereading this insurance card. So once I was able to get some English books, that made me so happy, so happy, because you have to nourish the brain. And then spiritually, just for me, my spirituality is trying to reach outside of myself for some sort of power greater than me, not necessarily some sort of dogmatic set particular religion, but just trying to keep my mind open and my spirit open to what's going around to me, the very world, and trying to maintain a positive attitude through that.
Right.
I did all these different things. I wrote letters, all these different things, and I set a schedule for myself and was pretty disciplined with it. So sometimes I wouldn't even have all the hours in the day, I couldn't even get to all the things I made per schedule.
Right.
And that made me feel as if I was doing something
right,
rather than just sitting in a cell.
You so easily could have made the opposite choice, the choice that essentially your roommate made. Although he did create a chessboard out of paper for the two of you to play chess, and
right,
that's about the only industrious thing he did the whole time you were with him. I think it's also impressive that you created this framework of discipline for yourself in a place where there seemed to be so little discipline. One of the frustrations you had was that the way the guards would treat you and whether or not a given thing would be permitted or not permitted, it would just be seemingly at the whimsy of that given guard on that given day. So, I mean, for the fact that it was a prison, it really didn't seem to have a strict list of rules and regulations. And in that kind of environment, in some ways, the last thing you'd think of on your own would be discipline. And yet you found it within yourself to sort of create that system of discipline for yourself, and we can tell it probably saved your sanity in many ways.
It did. Keeping my mind and body and spirit healthy completely saved my sanity, and that's something that goes back to sobriety as well. I learned that in sobriety, that I have to maintain a healthy mind, a healthy body, and a healthy spirit in order to be I wouldn't say happy, but a fulfilled, useful human being, because no one's happy all the time. So in prison, you can get various substances in prison, and I knew where to get them. I was aware of who was the drug dealers and who was not, and things were offered to me. Luckily, I think if I had not exerted an effort to maintain some sort of discipline, some sort of regiment to exercise all these areas in my body, I probably would have eventually wound up doing some substances in order to fill the soul-crushing void that is prison. And from there, it would have just been all downhill.
Hmm.
So discipline was hugely important,
right,
important. And it's something I didn't understand when I was a young man. My father's a disciplined man, and I think all kids hate it when their parents try and instill discipline in them, because that's the nature of children, and I know I hated it. But now that I'm an adult, I'm certainly grateful for the lessons he taught me, and by leading by example.
Right. Your book, of course, recounts a lot of the interesting people that you met in prison, your various roommates, and you describe actually a prison population that isn't quite like American prisons. There was not the racial tensions, the warring gangs, and so on. So there were positive things about that, and also a lot of fascinating people that you met, even those with whom you had a huge language barrier. But I really appreciate your powerful, discerning descriptions of some of the people whom you met and befriended there. We should talk about the charges brought against you and the fact that you were caught up in a Czech legal system, which you did not fully understand, And, of course, much of these legal transactions were occurring in a language you didn't understand. So it we can scarcely imagine how bewildering all of that would be. But on top of it, your book talks about how you also had to wrestle with the reality of what happened on May 24th, 2010. You were asked to recount a day which, in many respects, was a somewhat nondescript day 2 years earlier. And in the midst of trying to do that, you had to wrestle with the death of this young man at that concert and your role and to whatever extent you felt some responsibility for this young man's death. Just, we don't have enough time to, of course, go into every last detail about this sort of legal matter, but I wonder if you can just talk for a moment about that aspect of this ordeal on that very personal kind of level.
Yes. You know, I was handed these charges saying that I had assaulted this young man and had pushed him from the stage with intent to harm him. That immediately rang false in my ears. I'm like, no, of course not. I never tried to harm anyone. But it was all very confusing. Even the charges that they gave me were a bit, they seemed rather nebulous. I guess it was a bad translation. I didn't really understand what was going on in the fullest, which is not what you want to have going on in a legal situation. You want to know exactly what's going on. And the Czech legal system is very different than ours. In some ways, it had a few advantages, but overall, I view it as archaic. It needs a complete overhaul. Sitting there and trying to remember, basically, I was interrogated after I was arrested. I was sitting there and asked to remember what happened during 70 minutes of what is to me a regular night at work 2 years previously was extremely frustrating. I don't know many people who I can walk up to and say, what were you doing at work between 6 and 7:20 exactly 2 years ago on this date and have them say, oh, you know, I was filing a report to so-and-so or I was cooking it. A rack of ribs at the restaurant I worked at.
It would be impossible.
Nobody can do that. But yet I was asked to describe in great detail exactly what had happened during this small period of time 2 years previously. And while I was fairly certain that I had not intentionally harmed anyone, it caused great doubt in my mind and uncertainty at first because all I knew was what these people were telling me. It was like the police told me, you attacked this young man. And I was told that over and over and over. And I read this sheet of paper that they gave me that said this is what had happened over and over and over. And eventually that can seep into your conscious, particularly when you have no memory of what had happened. So it was quite frightening, and I felt with pretty great certainty that I was not guilty of the charges against me, and I felt with great certainty that I had not been drunk the evening of that concert. Otherwise, I would have had to say I don't know what happened, because as I said earlier, when I drink, everything that happens afterwards is a mystery to me. It's like I turn into a different person. So I sat and thought and prayed and meditated and read and asked myself questions over and over and over, wondering if I had, in fact, assaulted this young man. And the fact of the matter is that I have no memory of this young man whatsoever. I only have what I think happened. There was a young man who got on the stage there was no security, no effective security that night, which my band requires contractually. We have very stringent security requirements. And the promoter and the club had agreed to provide these things, otherwise we wouldn't have gone on stage. However, they did not provide these things. So from the first song, people were running on stage, bumping into the band, bumping into me, jumping off the stage. It's quite a dangerous situation. It's a small stage. So this young man kept on coming up on stage. And eventually I wrestled him to the ground, but I did not strike him. I didn't try and harm him in any way. I was pretty sure of that. When I was arrested, there were pictures of me on top of this young man holding him down. And the...
This is a monthly test of the Southeast and South Central Wisconsin Emergency Alert System. In the event of an emergency, this system would bring you important information. This test is now concluded.
Man, the young man in these photos called the police and said, "Wait a minute, I'm not dead, I'm alive." And he actually wound up going to court and testifying on my behalf and saying, "I was drunk. I should not have been on stage. And, you know, Mr. Bly did not strike me or abuse me in any way. He was just trying to deal with me the best way he could. His actions were appropriate." But that's it. Towards the end, for all that, I don't even know this. I only have this vague memory of wrestling with this young man. And I had to really ask myself, you know, did you do this? Is this just something that you don't remember? And when I was released on bail eventually and indicted, and they had asked me when I got out on bail, "Will you come back to trial if you're indicted?" And I said, "Absolutely. Absolutely, I will." And it wasn't because of any sort of threat of extradition. It's because I wanted to clear my name and try and give some answers to the family of this young man, who never once came at me in the press or in court or in private. They just wanted some answers. Their son was dead.
And you said more than once in the book that what was so important to you was to face this charge and this situation like a real man. I mean, you were not going to run from this.
No, I couldn't, because the fact of the matter is if I thought going to court, beyond giving hopefully some closure to the family, beyond that, I really wanted to know if I held any responsibility in this matter. If something had arisen during the court proceedings, if someone had given some sort of testimony or shown some sort of evidence that I had assaulted this young man, I would have pled guilty. This is a very serious charge, and it's not like I was walking away from a parking ticket in another state. And there's a fan of my band who's dead, and as a person who, as we discussed earlier, I drank at my problems. Basically, we drank at them, as I like to say, in order to deal with them. I ran away from my problems for so long with drinking. When I got sober, I couldn't run away from this. And if I was responsible for something, I not only needed to be held accountable, I wanted to be held accountable. That way I could look at myself in the mirror and say, okay, you took your lumps. You were a man. You did wrong, and now you have to accept responsibility for that. So that to me is, you know, that's the only way I can live today. Because if I'm not willing to take responsibility for my actions, then sooner or later I'm going to convince myself, oh, it'll be okay for you to take a drink, and from there I'll just wind up killing myself or drinking myself to death, or wind up back in prison anyway after I wreck my car and kill someone else. You know, it's not a situation where running away from my problems is an option for me today.
So being a man in this moment, being a real man, as you put it, was important for a lot of different reasons. Before we finish, I want to make sure to ask you about one other thing, which ended up making a very, very big difference for you within the walls of this prison. And I think as you describe this, you give the impression that this is something that remains in a very important part of your life to this very day. And I guess one of the reasons I feel like mentioning it is because it's not the first thing we would imagine when we think about someone who's the lead vocalist of a heavy metal band doing. Well, and there's a lot of things in this book that catch us off guard. I mean, reading Dietrich Bonhoeffer's Letters from Prison, for instance, is right. not what we immediately imagine you doing. Something else at one point that you did that made a huge difference was the creation of some kind of gratitude list. Tell us the first time you decided to do this in prison and why, and just how important you think, in fact, this was.
It was hugely important to me, and it remains hugely important to me to this day to maintain gratitude no matter what my circumstances are. And when I read Bonhoeffer, my father gave me this book. My lawyer and my father both gave me books, which I thought at first they were plotting to make me make me crazier. The first book that was given to me by my lawyer was Kafka's The Trial, which, I mean, if anyone's familiar with that work, it's not exactly a cheery work. It's about the most bewildering legal situation ever, and it doesn't end well. And I was like, oh, my God. And it was written in Prague, actually, you know, a stone's throw away from the prison. I thought, my lawyer is out of his mind giving me the trial. This doesn't bode well. But my lawyer is a very smart man, and it helped me sort of look at my own situation in a different light. But my father brought me Bonhoeffer's Letters and Papers from Prison, which doesn't end well for Bonhoeffer either. come to think of it, but I thought, oh, they're giving me these horrible books about incarceration. What are they doing? But both of them turned out to be hugely important to me. And Bonhoeffer writes about, he wrote about the first passage I turned to when I opened the book. He wrote a bit about the concept of gratitude. And the key thing for me with gratitude, and as Bonhoeffer writes, he wrote about what was prison like. He was locked up in Nazi Germany for a plot to kill Hitler, and eventually executed by the Nazi government. Was to maintain gratitude for the things that you do have and not become resentful about the things that you don't have. So for me, I decided to, I'd been doing this off and on for a few years by the time I was locked up, is just simply sit down and write a list of 10 or so things that you are grateful for in your life. And if you think I have nothing to be grateful for, then you can start with the fact that I'm breathing. You know, there's some people who are, you know, would give anything to be breathing anymore. They died too soon. So for me, sitting in prison and starting to write a gratitude list, it made me put things in perspective. I was like, I have food, I have shelter, I have a roof over my head. None of these things are the deluxe versions of food, clothes, or shelter, but I do in fact have them. I'm not stuck in some war zone. I'm not in, you know, starving to death in some country undergoing a water shortage or food crisis. I'm not being shot at by someone. I'm okay. I'm alive, and I'm in the moment. For me, maintaining gratitude for the things I do have and not becoming resentful about the things I don't have is key, because you can very easily, I think, particularly in this day and age of instant gratification and this high-tech internet communication era where everything is instantly there, it's easy to forget what we do have to be grateful for. When you just start wanting all these things, you know, you have to stop and take stock of your life and see what the great things that you do have are. You know, and for me in prison, it started with the basic necessities. Mm. And it helped me out greatly, and it does to this day. I try and maintain an attitude of gratitude. Mm.
Well, I, for one, am really grateful that you wrote this amazing book and shared this story. And I, for one, along with many other people, of course, are grateful that this legal mess ended as positively as it did with your exoneration of these charges. But it was a long, tense process. And you recount all of the details all along the way in just breathtaking fashion. It's a beautifully written memoir, and I commend you and congratulate you for it.
Thank you, sir.
The book again is called Dark Days. It's published by Da Capo Press, and its author, D. Randall Bly. D. Randall Bly, very best wishes to you, and thank you for being so generous with your time. It was a pleasure and honor for me to speak with you today about your wonderful book.
Thank you, sir. Thank you so much for having me.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, I look forward to welcoming back into our studios a faculty colleague of mine from Carthage College, Dr. Jerry Mast, Associate Professor of Political Science. Professor Mast joins us from time to time to offer his perspective on the political scene. And of course, there is no shortage of things to be talking about right now with Jerry Mast. On tomorrow's program, we will, first of all, be kind of taking stock as to what has been accomplished and maybe not accomplished in the first 10 months or so of the presidency of Donald Trump. We will be talking, of course, about the state of affairs with the Republican Party, the Democratic Party as well. We'll talk about how things are being done in Washington these days, what the relationship is currently between the White House and Capitol Hill. And, of course, the announcement yesterday from Robert Mueller's investigation with the initial indictments. What is ahead in terms of this investigation? What is ahead for the Trump administration? All that and more we will talk about with Jerry Mast on tomorrow's morning show. On Friday's morning show, I'm tentatively scheduled to speak with Leah Ingram, who is the author of The Complete Guide to How to Pay for College, which examines some of the ways in which the world of financial aid has changed a bit. And she offers some practical advice on what people can do to navigate that whole system. We remind you that The Morning Show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock, and you find The Morning Show archived on our website, wgtd.org. Support for The Morning Show comes from Jack and Drea, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, a unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe, Jack Andrea, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. Support for the morning show also comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed